Welcome to the Natural Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang, and this is episode number 279. For today's show about the upcoming midterm U.S. elections, I couldn't resist playing a bit of background music from the 60s protest song Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire, because on November 6th, 2018, the United States will hold elections for all 435 seats in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of Congress, and there is much to be concerned about in these times. These lower House seats are contested every 2 years, both alongside the presidential race and in midterm elections. There will also be 35 seats up for grabs in the Senate, the upper chamber, which holds elections every 2 years for about a third of its six-year positions. Those elections and the votes that will determine their results matter. But there are many in the Not Old Better audience and elsewhere that may be wondering whether their vote will count at all. Will my vote matter? Won't the social media bots determine the election? What about fake news? Well, our guest today, Professor Brendan Nyhan, will tell us that based on his research from the University of Michigan, it is not easy to influence or change people's votes in an election. As a matter of fact, according to Professor Nyhan, the answer is that a growing number of studies conclude that most forms of political persuasion seem to have little effect at all.
You know, do we know how that news feed is going to eventually affect your voting? Not in a simple, direct way. There's not strong evidence that things like fake news are moving massive numbers of votes. At the same time, we can't dismiss the possibility that there are effects, and that's something that's really being actively studied now.
That, of course, is our guest today, Professor Brendan Nyhan. Professor Brendan Nyhan is a professor of public policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. Professor Nyhan's work focuses on the misperceptions about politics. Professor Nyhan is well published and will post links to the University of Michigan homepage for Professor Nyhan. But impressively, Professor Nyhan is a 2018 Andrew Carnegie Fellow. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via internet phone, Professor Brendan Nyhan. Brendan Nyhan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It is really great to talk to you. Of course, politics is on our mind. You cannot turn on the TV without seeing political ads. You and I both come from California, a state where it's vast, it's diverse. Politics are sometimes referred to as quote-unquote special, and you sometimes even hear the term party of California because of all the diversity there. What attracted you to political work?
I've always been interested in politics. I grew up following it in the news in California. I interned for a state legislator there. I even wrote a senior thesis in high school about the rise of Pat Buchanan in the 1992 presidential primary. So I've always had politics in my blood, and it's something I came back to as an adult, working in politics and journalism, and then eventually studying it as a political scientist.
That's an interesting story. Thanks very much for sharing that. And we'll kind of jump forward to today. And your focus now is really on the misperceptions about politics. And with the midterms coming up, there are lots of things to talk about. But let's focus a little bit on this idea of misperceptions about politics and how they might impact the voting coming up.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I would want to be clear with your audience that the answer isn't always as simple as it might seem. We tend to think that people vote because of the factual beliefs that they hold. But in some cases, it's the other way around. They may be amassing factual beliefs to support a vote preference or partisan affiliation that they already hold. So understanding the effect of misperceptions in politics and on elections isn't as simple as it might seem. In some cases, for instance, voters who are misinformed, that misperception may be intended to demobilize them, to encourage them not to participate. Politicians may also be using false claims to try to mobilize their own supporters. So it's not a question necessarily of persuasion. It's about mobilization.
Mm-hmm. And today's mobilization is at our fingertips because of social media. And I think it's interesting to go back and kind of touch on this fact-checking idea that you mentioned, that you refer to, because the media makes a big deal about fact-checking, that it's vital. But I'm not so sure that is reaching the populace. I don't know that we're thinking so much about fact-checking, and it seems to be a problem. Is the problem that we have too many facts and they're everywhere with social media? And really, is everyone kind of prepared, you know, just paying too much attention to their own news feed? And then you, in my research of you, I found this excellent quote. You say, the president more and more is calling into question every other source of information besides himself. I thought that was relevant to this question too about fact checking.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the basic notion of the role that facts play, which I alluded to a few moments ago. And I think it's an important starting point here. The good news is there's more fact checking than ever before. The fact checking movement is one of the most important developments in political journalism over the last decade. There are more fact checks available to you as a voter than there ever were before. You can look up high quality information from established respected sources at a moment's notice on Google if you'd like to research a claim that you've heard. So there's more and more high quality information out there than ever before. But it often seems that it's lost in the sea of misinformation. And that's the challenge I think we face. The trouble is, I think we misunderstand the role and effects of fact-checking when we think it's simply a matter of people seeking out correct information. The fact-checkers, of course, try to play that role and in some cases can help people, but it's only a certain set of people who would ever read a fact check in the first place. Most Americans simply don't pay very close attention to politics and don't spend a lot of time researching any political claims that they hear, right? And that's normal. People have busy lives. They have different priorities. That's okay. But the problem is that the people who pay the closest attention to politics, the ones who we might think would go seek out fact checks, are often the ones who have the strongest commitments to their preferred party, to a particular candidate, to the president of the United States. And in those cases, they may not be interacting with factual information as a dispassionate, unbiased observer, but instead as someone who is trying to find out, trying to reach a conclusion that is consistent with their preferences. Right. Maybe not intentionally. Right. No one feels like they're doing that in the moment, myself very much included. But we're all vulnerable to that as human beings. We have preferences about who's right in any given argument. You'd like your side to be right and the other side to be wrong. And that affects how we think about the political world in a really powerful way. It's not all powerful, right? There are certain elements of reality that just break through, right? For instance, it's hard to deny that the economy is good when it's really good. And it's hard to deny that the economy is bad when it's really bad because the evidence is all around us. But lots of issues in political life don't have that property, right? Until climate change starts flooding the streets in Florida, you may not think climate change is real. Right? Until you may never believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or that 9/11 was not an inside job, because the evidence of those things is not available to you and salient in the same way as something like the economy. And so it's very challenging to overcome those barriers to accurate factual beliefs. Okay. So what does this mean? It means that we have to be careful about assuming that fact-checking is a kind of magical solution to this problem. Right? Many people will never pay attention to it, or if they do, they may dismiss his conclusions when they're contrary to what they like to believe. Does that mean fact-checking has no purpose? Of course not. Right? I think it can play an important role in constraining politicians who are nervous about negative coverage and may be dissuaded from making more extreme false claims if they know they'll be held to account in the media. Right. So I do think fact-checking has a role, but I think it's also important to realize the vulnerabilities we all have as human beings in forming factual beliefs.
Some of the fact-checking is even complicated by this bubble that we kind of envelop ourselves in with social media. We subscribe to certain things. The quote-unquote algorithms send us particular pieces of news that maybe keep us within kind of a frame of reference about facts. And I'm wondering about your research. Does it show that some of these news feeds from social media actually do impact voting behavior?
I'm not sure we know yet how much effect social media algorithms and news feeds, et cetera, have on voting. But we are starting to learn more about how they shape the information we come into contact with, and even what that looks like, what the average person's information diet consists of. People may have heard of this idea of echo chambers that you've kind of alluded to, that people in their social media in their news consumption more generally are disproportionately consuming news from like-minded sources. The good news is that behavioral evidence shows that those extreme versions of echo chambers are relatively rare. It's only a small subset of Americans who are overwhelmingly consuming like-minded news, you know, conservatives who overwhelmingly watch and read Fox, right? And liberals who overwhelmingly read and watch, read the Huffington Post and the Daily Coast and websites like that. Those folks are relatively rare. Those are relatively unusual people. Most people aren't in echo chambers to that extent. Right? So I think that's good news. You know, the kind of information dystopia that many people warned about is not upon us. But that doesn't mean we're out of the woods either. What happens in those echo chambers can have larger effects, right? So to take an example from the 2016 election, in our research, we found that fake news consumption was heavily concentrated among the 10% of Americans with the most conservative information diets. And they helped magnify that the spread of that information, in part through channels like Facebook, right, where many more people were exposed to it. Right? And the people who have those kinds of echo chamber style information diets, they're often going to be more politically involved and engaged. So they may be more likely to vote, more likely to write letters to the editor, more likely to contribute to campaigns. And in those ways, they may be more likely to be heard politically. So it's everyone's problem if these echo chambers are out there. But the last point I want to make, Paul, is that this isn't just something we can dismiss as a few people on the extremes. We're all vulnerable to the kinds of biases that that social media can create, right? So I want to share the conclusions of a study actually that was done by some data scientists at Facebook when they tried to understand the extent to which people were getting like-minded information from the site. And what they found was if they were trying to understand, well, why were people getting more news from their side than the other side on Facebook? And when they tried to disaggregate that, when they tried to separate out how much of it was from the algorithm showing you things it thought you would like. Well, that was part of it. But part of it is who we were friends with, and part of it is what we chose to click on. Right? And so, our friend network is going to funnel us disproportionately, like-minded information, right? Our friends tend to share our beliefs and viewpoints on average, right? And then the information we select may tend to correlate with what we'd like to believe to be true. And in all of those ways, it can shape the information we get. So, do we know how that news feed is going to eventually affect your voting? Not in a simple, direct way. There's not strong evidence that things like fake news are moving massive numbers of votes. At the same time, we can't dismiss the possibility that there are effects, and that's something that's really being actively studied now.
So do you think then that the upcoming midterm elections are going to be heavily participated in? Is that your guess at this point? I mean, what are the tea leaves saying to you about the upcoming midterms?
It's a really interesting question. Political scientists have found over and over again that the composition of midterm elections, like the one that's coming up, a congressional election that's halfway between the presidential elections every 4 years, the composition of that electorate is typically very different. It tends to be a more unrepresentative set of voters, differentially whiter and older in particular. And turnout levels on average tend to be lower. There isn't a presidential campaign to mobilize people, right? Either directly by ads and phone calls and door knocks, and indirectly by creating a high salience political atmosphere that motivates people to go out and cast their vote. Those things aren't present here, but at the same time, our politics has been so visceral of late, and President Trump is so controversial that some indications are that voter interest in this election is unusually high for a midterm, right? So I certainly wouldn't expect presidential levels of voter turnout, but I do think people are hearing about and thinking about this campaign maybe in a way that's relatively unusual for a midterm election. As a result of that, actually, we don't have as much confidence in our ability to project these outcomes as we might expect. Right. So one example is that Democrats are running candidates in almost every seat held by Republicans, which is very unusual. And they have those candidates have much more money than most House challengers would typically have. Now, most incumbents will win. That's what always happens in elections. But you have a relatively high number of these well-funded challengers who can mount credible campaigns, including turning folks out to vote on their behalf. So it's going to be a fascinating, week or so here before the election.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brendan Nyhan, your time is so valuable. We appreciate it so much. I just have one final question for you. In the news, certainly, and on everybody's minds and lips over the last few weeks has been the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, confirmation to the Supreme Court. You've recently written about the public reaction, specifically that some of this visceral, you know, movement could even undermine the public's confidence in the Supreme Court. This sounds devastating to a body that I think Americans have always found a great deal of trust in. And here are justices that are appointed for life. If this is something that is undermined, then we ought to be really pretty concerned.
Yeah, the legitimacy of the rule of law is an important bulwark of liberal democracy. And here I'm using liberal in the sense of meaning a democracy based in the rule of law. Right? So maintaining the institutional legitimacy of the Supreme Court and the rule of law more generally is something that every American has a stake in. The Supreme Court, though, is one of the institutions that's been challenged by the rise of intense partisan polarization in recent years and decades. Now, the court has largely been immune to that trend to date. They've the public's perceptions of the court have shown that it is perceived to have a high degree of legitimacy, and that it survived even the Clarence Thomas hearings, which were very controversial in 1991, and even the Bush v. Gore decision, which was exceptionally controversial. The decision that resolved the 2000 election. So perceptions of the court have been quite resilient. But in this article you referenced, which was published on the Monkey Cage blog on the Washington Post's website, I argue that there are reasons to suspect that the Kavanaugh confirmation could be a meaningful turning point in perceptions of the court for three reasons. The first is, of course, that it brought seemingly unprecedented levels of partisan polarization over a confirmation to that process. Right? During the Clarence Thomas hearings, it was actually Democrats who chaired those hearings and in some cases questioned Anita Hill quite skeptically. In this case, the partisan lines were drawn very clearly, and you're seeing more Democrats questioning Republican dominance of the Supreme Court, particularly after the circumstances in which Neil Gorsuch and now Brett Kavanaugh were confirmed. The second way in which the legitimacy of the court may be challenged is because of the allegations that have been made, credible allegations of sexual harassment and assault, respectively, against two sitting justices of the Supreme Court in Clarence Thomas and now Brett Kavanaugh. Right? So that may create a difference in how especially women see the court, and that difference may be growing as more women run for and hold elected office in this country, which is a trend we've been seeing in this election. And finally, and most importantly, maybe the point I made in this article is that these that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh were confirmed under historically unusual circumstances. Only they are the only two justices in the contemporary era, the period since Ronald Reagan first took office, who were nominated by a president who failed to win the popular vote and confirmed by senators representing a minority of Americans. Right? The court is not a majoritarian institution. It was not designed to simply transmit the preferences of the majority of the public, but that's an unusually narrow base to wield such power in a democracy, and it may make the court more vulnerable to challenge than it has been in the past.
That is a fascinating metric to hear you talk about, the one about the victory and the base. That is really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well, Brendan Nyhan, thank you so much for your time today. I could talk to you for a long time, but I know you're busy, and we're going to let some of this kind of play out. And I wonder, maybe you'll be open to joining us post-midterm election. We can do a little bit of a follow-up with you.
Sure, I'd love to.
Yeah,
thanks very much.
Thank you, Brendan. Good talking to you.
All right, you too.
I have one other thing. With respect to the mass shooting over the weekend, I just want to express my deepest grief and solidarity with all my Jewish friends in the Not Old Better Show audience around the world after the heinous violence perpetrated against congregants of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. As a person of faith, it is my constant prayer that God will heal and protect those affected by such tragic events. When the security and religious freedom of our Jewish brothers and sisters is violated, we all suffer. Houses of worship should be safe. They should be inviolate places for people of all faiths to join in sacred fellowship and seek communion with God. I have to say, I condemn the environment of hate-filled rhetoric that has become so prevalent. Anti-Semitism has no place in our society. It is responsibility of good people everywhere to speak out and stand up for each other's rights to worship and live peacefully. Thank you.